This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today we have a conference call discussing energy solutions for low-income housing. Our guest panel is Jason Kulishevsky, University of Buffalo Regional Institute, Rob Hammond with Bira Energy, and Michael Walton with Green Spaces Chattanooga. John Walter should be joining us at some point. He's with Repower Yolo in Davis, California. So, Jason, why don't you go ahead and start us out with a couple of minutes of introduction and talk about what's going on in your area on the topic with energy solutions for low-income housing.
Perfect. Hello, everybody. As Sierra said, my name is Jason Kulishevsky. I am the Clean Energy Coordinator for the University at Buffalo's Regional Institute. We do a lot of work with municipalities on planning-related projects, often related in sustainability through transportation, building efficiency, overall efficiencies. And over the past year and a half, I've been working with municipalities across Erie and Niagara County in western part of New York State to reduce energy consumption and invest in sustainability measures and making renewables more accessible to residents. Prior to coming on to UB last year, I did work with a not-for-profit organization called Push Buffalo that did a lot of work in residential energy efficiency and renewables, overall neighborhood sustainability, and a lot of that work was focused in exactly what our topic is today, residential energy efficiency and sustainability. So while I was the director at Push Green, a lot of the work that we did was surrounded in helping folks in the low-income community connect to essentially existing programs and existing support systems that were there through New York State's Energy Research and Development Authority, better known as NYSERDA. They have residential and small commercial energy efficiency programs that essentially help building owners, renters, tenants, access free or reduced cost energy efficiency services such as free energy assessments, and then working through beyond the assessment to connect with financing and some education around, you know, the results of the energy assessment. I myself am a Building Performance Institute certified building professional, so I understand a lot about the building science that goes into making buildings more energy efficient. And when we're talking about buildings in western New York and upstate New York, we do have some of the oldest housing stock in the country. And so a lot of that, when you're talking about low-income renters, they're living in some of this very, very old housing stock that was built before things like energy code and before insulation was being widely used. So a big part of the effort here in New York has been to go back into these communities that essentially have some of this very old housing stock and try to upgrade it and make it more sustainable by adding insulation, putting in, you know, some energy saving things like replacing old out-of-date light bulbs that tend to be a little bit more expensive for the lower income household, or it's just lower on the priority list. So NYSERDA created a few programs specifically for the low to moderate income households. One of them is called Empower New York. And essentially what that does is it helps qualified residents, homeowners, or tenants connect to the free energy assessment. And then there's roughly a $5,000 budget for energy efficiency measures to happen inside of those households. Oftentimes that is putting insulation in walls, replacing light bulbs, and doing a basic education for homeowners. If it is within the heating season and there is an issue with an outdated heating system or a dangerous heating system that happens to be leaking carbon monoxide or something like that, there is an emergency system in place in New York to also replace those. Beyond the very low income scale, so like heat eligible households, There is also a program called Assisted Home Performance that essentially gets the folks who are just above that low income range on the income scale to help offer them a 50% grant that would pay for any of the energy efficiency upgrades that were identified in this energy assessment. The last thing I just thought I would want to kind of touch on in my opening here is that just earlier this year, Beyond Energy Efficiency, NYSERDA has also launched this program called Solar for All, which essentially helps these low-income tenants and property owners connect to community solar arrays. It's not a subscription. There's no fee involved. Essentially, income-qualified homeowners sign up with NYSERDA to connect with one of these Solar for All community solar arrays, and a portion of that array is dedicated to their bill associated with their account to reduce their energy consumption. And the big part of the reason for a lot of these low-income programs is to, A, make these buildings more sustainable and efficient, but also to stretch out some of these program dollars, because if we're making homes and buildings use less energy and consume less or get their energy from renewable sources, then we could stretch out some of those safety net dollars to help more families in New York State. So those are the three biggest programs for the low-income residents in New York State that are happening right now. And so I guess I'd leave it there, and we can kind of get into it more details if there's questions or anything like that a little bit later in the call.
All right. Thanks so much, Jason. Rob, why don't you tell us what's happening over in your neck of the woods?
Good morning. This is Rob Hammond. I'm out in California. I have a micro company in the Central Valley of California. We've been working on zero net energy buildings since 2001. And in fact, the Energy Commission recently dubbed me the grandfather of zero net energy. While we're a tiny company, we leverage ourselves and our friendly companies to form a consortium where we draw on expertise of other small companies to go after larger projects. And for 10 years, I was the lead for a Building America team, helping that program design and build more efficient homes. I tended to focus on communities as opposed to single homes. More recently, we've stretched to the multifamily, low-income multifamily market, and we completed a project a year or so ago. It's now been written up, and in fact, it just won an ASHRAE award for energy efficiency. And the goal of that project was to see how close we could come cost-effectively to meet zero net energy in an existing low-income multifamily complex. And we managed to reduce gas use by 50%, electricity use by about 20%, and then we did community solar to pretty close to make up the remaining electric use. We've now got another project going, which basically follows on that earlier one. The one that won the award is in Lancaster, California. That's where the complex is, which is high desert. The new project, we've got one complex in Ontario, California, Southern California, and one in Northern California in Fresno. Some barriers that we've run into that really make life more difficult. It's already difficult because of the cost and the difficulties in getting low-income properties to pencil, especially with split incentives problem. But worse than that, the first project, the Beechwood project in Lancaster, we ran into asbestos, which doubled the cost of the efficiency upgrades. And then in the Fresno project, which we're working on now, we've run into the problem that the electrical infrastructure is too small to handle upgraded equipment. They're using very old evaporative coolers that are nasty, any active devices that we put on the system make it so we need to increase the panel size, increase the conductor size to the panels, and possibly upgrade the transformers. And this just pushes the whole thing beyond any possibility of being cost effective. So that's a new, I think, upcoming social issue, is how one might deal with that problem in the existing multifamily market. That's a quick summary of where we are.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Michael? Walton?
This is Michael Walton. I'm the Executive Director at Green Spaces. We are a nonprofit based in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Our mission is advancing sustainability, living, working, and building in Chattanooga and the surrounding region. So we've had pretty heavy involvement in the low-income space for the last 4 years with a program called Empower Chattanooga. We started that with a sort of overall analysis of two maps, basically. One map was looking at energy use intensity. We have our municipal utility has a smart grid, and they were able to basically divide energy use per residential address by the square foot of home at that address, and then aggregate that up to a 1 square mile grid of their service territory. So we looked at that map, and then we looked at calls for utility assistance to our United Way 211 hotline. So basically people that have received a cutoff notice and are calling to get help to pay their electric bills. When we sort of overlaid those, we could see that a specific number of neighborhoods had sort of outsized energy burden. So in the winter, they were using 43% more energy per square foot than the average home in Chattanooga. And then we used that to then identify the neighborhoods that we would work in. We went in and did focus groups in each neighborhood to sort of co-design programming with residents that we could sort of tailor the response to what their needs were. We ended up from that experience doing a series of community events paired with free workshops that we teach low-cost and no-cost ways for people to lower their electric bills. We have our goal for those workshops is around 100 attendees a month. And those are given at various locations in the neighborhoods and at locations where people get assistance paying their electric bills. The last couple of speakers talked about the sort of split incentive. A lot of the attendees are renters. They don't have the ability to make energy efficiency investments, even if they had the money. And so we really just focus on the sort of how energy works, how you use energy, how you lose energy, and really simple ways of improving energy performance. So that's sort of our foundational work. And then on top of that, we have a number of different programs that are working on going deeper. So we have a workforce development program. We basically work with at-risk young adults from the same neighborhoods where we it's a paid 12-week training program. We teach soft skills, community development skills, and then energy efficiency and construction readiness skills. We have a partnership with our local utility in the city of Chattanooga. The three of us were part of a Department of Energy accelerator for clean energy in low-income neighborhoods. And the that workforce development program came out of that. We're working on the Green and Healthy Homes Initiative, which I can get into more detail about if you guys want, but it basically uses energy or using healthcare savings to pay for health and energy improvements in low-income homes. We are also exploring on-meter tariffs, so the pay-as-you-save. We are also working on a citywide ordinance to require a bare minimum level of energy performance in any rental unit. And let's see, we're also currently working on a mixed income, mixed use development that's targeting net zero energy for at least a multifamily portion, if not the whole development. What else do we have going on? Oh, we also work in all of the schools in the neighborhoods that our Empower program is in. So we have energy clubs in the schools. We do we do other programs with those schools, like an electric race car challenge. And then we just are about to expand those free energy workshops into the rural counties around Chattanooga. In a partnership with the Southeast Tennessee Human Resources Agency. So I can go into more detail about any of those things if you have questions, but that's sort of the high-level overview.
All right. Anybody have comments or questions about each other's discussion?
I have a question. I think it's for Michael. That Chattanooga, as you were talking, I'm recalling that Chattanooga managed to put up microgrids using cable Wi-Fi to finance the whole thing. Are you related
uh-huh.
to that and been a partner to that, or can you give me any idea on how?
Yeah, so basically what – what happened is in, I guess, 2009, our local power company, EPB, they're a distributor. So TVA is the generation and transmission, and EPB distributes in the local market, and they're municipally owned. They installed basically a fiber optic backbone for their electrical grid, and then we're able to provide communication services to customers throughout their service territory in addition to electric service. And so that has been tremendously successful for them. It has actively prevented rate increases because of the revenue that it's generated. It's prevented the communications revenue has helped prevent electric rate increases, or at least minimize them. And it has also allowed them to be a lot more strategic in how they think about energy programs. And so they're actually partnering with us on that net zero energy development to basically come up with an energy as a service platform for it. So that they would basically help finance the energy components of the development off balance sheet of the construction loan, and then make money on the margin of that, basically.
Mm-hmm. Are there any write-ups on that?
On the smart grid or the particular on that particular project?
The smart grid in general, how that whole thing, which is
yeah, I'm sure there's I can reach out to the community relations person there and get something like that.
That'd be great. Appreciate that.
Anybody else?
Yeah, this is Jason. I also have a question for Michael regarding the programs, the educational programs that you're doing in conjunction with the schools. And I'm wondering how that relationship came to be, and if you could just talk through how that kind of evolved into this energy club and the programming within the schools.
Yeah, I would say so. There were sort of two different starting points for that conversation. One was we found that the schools were one of the most efficient sort of outreach points within a neighborhood. You know, if we want people to turn out for a community event, we could send backpack stuffers in, or we could drop off backpack stuffers and they would put them in every single kid's backpack to send home, and their parents are basically like guaranteed to read it. And so it sort of started with that, and then there were a couple projects that allowed us to partner with the schools. We did a design thinking competition focused on one of the public parks, and so that was sort of our first experiment with working really with a school structurally, and then that led to we started a Green School Summit for just the broader and anybody that wanted to come, not specifically in the low-income neighborhoods that we were working on, and then that sort of spawned these energy clubs and the Green PRE, which is a Green Power USA, like an electric car design, build, and race challenge. So it really sort of evolved and grew, and we're sort of continuing to build on that relationship.
Great. And just a follow-up to that is the funding for this, is how is this program kind of funded?
Oh, man. Our organization is funded from a wide range of revenue streams. We use we go after grants. We get we have about 60 corporate memberships and sponsorships locally. We get a little bit of money from the city. We get a little bit of money from TVA and EPB. We have revenue that came in when somebody else was mentioning net zero. We developed a series of four market rate net zero energy homes and sold them. And so we have revenue from that goes to the Empower program. And we have just individual donors as well.
Fantastic. Wow. That's very broad. Thank you.
This is Rick Riebstein from Boston University. I have a question for anybody. I'm curious about the insulation issues that you were either helping people with or recommending, particularly spray foam, which has some serious toxicity issues, but which maybe you can manage. And I was wondering which kinds of insulation you recommended to people.
So this is Jason. I'll jump in on this one. Each home, I think, has its own individual needs. And I can say that based on what application was being kind of identified as the best one, we were using, so for instance, oftentimes around the rim joist of a home, is where there's a lot of cold air that gets in the wintertime, and so oftentimes it was like a spray foam application that was suggested to the homeowner. around the rim joists of the home, kind of where the foundation meets the home itself in the building. Other than that, though, most of the insulation applications were cellulose-based insulation, so there is less toxicity associated with some of that off-gassing. The spray foam application as well, although there is off-gassing, it's been compared to like off-gassing of a new carpet or the new car scent, or when you buy any kind of new item of furniture, you know, there's some off-gassing associated with that. And there were a few times that I can say too, because none of the activities that homeowners kind of were participating in were mandatory. So if they did have like heightened sensitivity to some of the chemical makeup of some of the products that were being used, we would also work with the installer and the construction companies that were doing a lot of the work to find a better solution that was less toxic. Oftentimes, because of the built already and being a retrofit, it is more often like it's a blown-in insulation application than, say, even a like a roll of fiberglass, for instance, that gets used when like a new home is being built, for example.
Yeah, this is Rob. That's what we've found is we don't use the spray-in. The access, in addition to the issues that you mentioned, just the access is very difficult. At least in the buildings that we're working on, generally they don't have a large open space ceiling. They tend to be flat roofed or close to it, with a fairly shallow attic space that's difficult to access. And in the Beechwood project, we had no access to it. We thought until we wanted to change out all the ductwork, and to do that, we cut a hole in the hallway where there was a drop ceiling and a distribution box. And we pulled everything out from there and then put in new ductwork that was properly connected and sealed, and then embedded that in, just filled the entire chamber that held the distribution box with blown in fiberglass, and then sealed that up. and those ducts were that change out was basically, it took us from poor leaky ducts to essentially ducts in conditioned space in terms of performance. We also found that there were pathways from there to the attic area, and we blew insulation into those areas. We couldn't insulate the entire ceiling that way. You couldn't reach it. But we got about 25 to 30% of the ceiling area we were able to add in blown-in insulation. And again, we couldn't, even if we wanted to, we couldn't put in blown foam there because it had to reach about 30 feet from the nozzle. So it would have never worked.
Mm. Thank you. We did some work on the foam issue, and people can become sensitized from exposure, it's a very powerful sensitizer. And combining the two parts is absolutely critical. And then EPA recommends a 72-hour, or they used to recommend, a 72-hour period before reoccupancy, but a lot of contractors ignore that because they don't want to inconvenience their customers. And then the other issue that we saw was that when people went in with the kits, for just a little bit of spray foam, that they really didn't pay attention to the ventilation and the breathing protection that the more concerted foam operations might or and more likely did. And so those people who are often transient part-time workers who might be were subject to this risk of sensitization, which can be pretty serious. Which is not to say it doesn't have its place, but really these are important management issues.
I wanted to see if Sherry Reuter has anything to contribute. What's going on in Wisconsin, Sherry?
Oh, thanks, Sarah. I have to say that I got on particularly late, so after the presentations were made, so I'm kind of treading sensitive water here. But I would say, living in Wisconsin, that the issue of insulating sill plates and rim joists are really important, and certainly a solid foam is the only way to stop the air infiltration. So it's used a lot here.
Are there any energy-type policies or anything going on in the energy area as far as the low-income policy is concerned, Sherry?
Before you go there, can I interject something in terms
sure.
of there is another currently somewhat expensive, but there's another possible problem, a possible way to seal the buildings without using spray foam. And that is, if you're familiar with work done at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab on aerosol sealing of ductwork some years ago, that's now commercialized and fairly successful in terms of sealing existing ductwork. But half a dozen years ago, we funded we funded the Western Cooling Center to try moving that approach to buildings, and that's come quite a way since then, and we're finding that it is possible and it may be cost effective to use spray. Well, it's a different distribution. Basically, you fill the room with small aerosol-sized particles, and they fill the holes in the envelope, and then you can add whatever insulation you deem appropriate.
I've got a quick question about that. Is that AeroBarrier? Is that what that product is?
Which one?
For the self-sealing aerosol thing?
But for the buildings. That, as far as I know, it's not commercialized yet, but it's in the process. So maybe they closed on that.
There was something like that at IBS that won Best in Show called AERO Barrier.
Yeah, that is
on
that
below
is
the ceiling.
That's the same group. Yep.
Okay.
There's something called AeroSeal. Is that the same thing?
I believe so.
Yeah, that's AeroBarrier is the product. AeroSeal is the company.
Yeah, it's Mark Madeira at the Western Cooling Center. It used to be at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, and then when that aerosol sealing of ductwork got commercialized,
has there been testing done on the health implications of that product?
I'm sure there have, but I'm not familiar with them.
Okay. And is it some? Do you know if there was any testing done on an existing home, or has it really been designed primarily for new construction?
Both. They started with new construction. It's a lot easier. We actually, at that Beechwood project that I was talking about, we sealed the community center using that approach. And they haven't had many building jobs go wrong, but that was one that did. We moved all the furniture to the middle of the room and then covered everything with about 3 mil plastic, which was taped down to the carpet and the wallboard, the wood that goes along the baseboard, and that seal came loose, and so then the aerosol got underneath the tarp, and we had a pretty good mess on our hands. But they're finding ways to simplify and avoid those problems. But the best approach is, in the multifamily at least, is do that, seal them up as they roll over to a new tenant. They typically pull out the carpet and other things like that, and it's empty, seal it then, and then you avoid a lot of problems.
So were you doing outreach to landlord associations?
Yeah, we most of our, we're a research organization, not as much, we don't do a lot of programmatic work. It's more the lead up to that. But we work with some larger companies that manage or own the multifamily properties dwelling units are all leased, rented. Sorry.
Jerry, any comments about any of this?
No.
Okay. So anything going on in the area of community-type solar with low-income housing?
Well, we did, this is Rob again, we on all the projects that we've done or are doing, community solar was part of it. But what I mean by that is, for instance, at Beechwood, they had parking covers installed, and then that became the structure to hold the photovoltaics. I can't remember how large the system was, but it was pretty good size, and it was owned and operated by the company that owned the property. And then they distributed the generation credit among the tenants according to the square footage of their dwelling units. So it was virtual net metering was done there.
Sounds like it's important. Is anybody else doing anything like that?
So, Sierra, this is Jason over in Buffalo. So across New York State, there's the Solar for All program. And this is a program specifically designed for low-income renters that, can't have a solar array put on their roof. It's essentially New York State is buying into portions of scheduled solar developments that are being installed across New York State, and portions of those arrays are essentially being set aside for low-income customers so that they can access renewable energy through the community solar array. That's one example, but there's also a few other examples that have been kind of coming up over the past few months here in Western New York One of them with the organization I was formerly with, Push Buffalo, we're able to redevelop an abandoned school in the city of Buffalo. It's got several office spaces in there, but there's also 30 apartment units for seniors in this building that has a solar array on it, and essentially they're offsetting portions of each one of the 30 rental units with solar. So they're touting that as a kind of community-owned model of what a community solar array could look like on an individual building. And then more recently, as I've been working with the city of Lockport in Niagara County, New York, to do their solarize program that helps, residents get access to discounted solar. That's not a low-income initiative, but something that is kind of growing out of that initiative is some interest from their municipal housing authority to install solar in conjunction with the municipality to install solar on the municipal housing to offset renters' utility costs, essentially to eliminate electric costs for renters in the housing authority units. So those are some other community solar arrays that aren't a remote net metered, but they would be directly, tied into the building that they would be servicing too. So there's some interesting models here in New York as far as how to make sure that the low-income resident can still have access to solar because, the projects are hard to pencil out because of incentives and things like that. And so I think with New York State kind of coming in as almost a good, anchor institution, if you will, to help support the development of solar, but also making sure that solar is being deployed to low-income residents, I think is a pretty interesting model. I think there's more to kind of be looked into as far as how it all really works as far as the financing of a project and how to make that work. But I think it's an interesting model to make solar accessible for the low-income household.
So can I ask, are those housing units that the state is investing in the solar for, are they owned by a developer or a management company, or what? Are they privately owned buildings, or are they state-owned buildings or city-owned buildings?
So for the Solar for All program, that's the statewide initiative. Those are large scale arrays that are being developed by private entities, and the state is essentially subscribing to a portion of that for the low-income homeowner or renter. So it wouldn't necessarily have to be a state-owned property or somebody who is receiving some kind of subsidy for their housing, but it's really identifying those people who are on like a heating or an electrical assistance program and helping them offset some of their energy consumption with solar. As for the ones that are kind of being explored on the municipal housing units themselves, those are specifically for renters in those buildings. So it would be like a multi-unit building would essentially have a portion, if not all, of a tenant's electric utility kind of included in the cost.
Okay, so this is Sierra. I have one question for you. How are they installed on a multi-unit building? Panels? You said they were like individual panels.
So in the city of Lockport, they're just kind of developing this idea, and it's only a concept. But for Push Buffalo, who actually has the array installed on top of the school, it's a solar array that goes into a large meter for the building. Well, the way that it's metered is essentially all of the apartment units have their utility included.
Okay. So it's not an individual per unit. It's a collective for the buildings.
Exactly.
Okay, I was under.
I just want to jump in.
Yeah.
I think there's a sort of an important point there that people can for people to think about. When you do that, when utilities are included, you know, the especially the, like the housing choice vouchers are set up such that the owner of the building can get the utility stipend basically per unit regardless of what the electric rates are, and that varies by state, but most states it's set up so that there is sort of like a potential funding mechanism there. If you've got housing choice voucher units and you put in solar and you include utilities in their rent, basically there's sort of an opportunity for arbitrage that can help finance the solar.
Anybody? Okay. Any other thoughts and comments?
I guess so. Just along those lines, so we've, in addition to our development, there's another low-income housing development here that Wishrock just bought. They renovated to improve the energy efficiency, and they're in the process of doing a 300 kW solar array as part of that project, and they are using it to just really improve the cash flow and as well as the resilience of the unit.
And I'd just like to add that there are some very major sort of hidden costs to doing energy efficiency in older multifamily complexes, two of the barriers being asbestos and the electric supply system that may be undersized to put in newer technologies. And I think that's going to become a social issue. If it doesn't, then we have a really badly underserved low-income problem. And if it does become an issue, then we have to figure out a way to fund it. And I think that's an upcoming issue that we should take on sooner rather than later.
Yeah, but didn't you hear asbestos is now a fine building material to use? You can get it from Russia.
I actually am curious as to whether you enclosed it or you removed it.
We removed it, but we only took out about a 4x8 section of the drop ceiling. But it took 2 or 3 days to have it exposed and remediated, and the cost was high.
I'm also assuming that you complied with the lead renovation rule.
We complied with all the rules that we were at least aware of. I can't speak to that particular one.
That didn't trigger an asbestos remediation requirement higher ceiling? You could just do a portion of it?
We only had to remediate we didn't disturb any other areas of the building that may have had asbestos in it, so we only had to remediate where we where we affected the material.
Does anybody have any feedback on the percentage of homes in each city that actually have done energy efficiency improvements of any kind?
As far as I know, the low-income market is very poorly served in terms of serious or deep efficiency retrofits.
What about the entire city in general? Just curious to know. It's such an invasive process to get people to do that. I wondered how many people are actually doing it. Anybody know?
So, wait, what was the question again, Sierra?
Well, I'm curious to know in any one city approximately how many people are actually doing energy efficiency improvements in their homes or buildings even.
Oh, so, I mean, in our market, we're doing about 100 of these deep energy retrofits in low-income households a year. We're trying to up that number. And then overall, I think the eScore program that our local power company runs is, I think they're in the, like, 500 to 1,000 units a year range.
Yeah, not even looking at low-income housing, but, like, as a percentage of 10%, 20%,
50%. Oh, no. I would say it's in the low single digits.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
That the Clean Energy Jobs Midwest report just came out showed that probably 88% of the jobs, over 700,000 clean energy jobs in the 12 Midwest states were energy efficiency employment.
That's good to know. Anything else? No, go ahead. Yeah, I was curious to know how many of these programs that we have going in this country with the utilities and such are effective to the point where people are actually acting on them.
Sierra, I can look into getting some statistical numbers for you as far as how many people have signed up versus how many people have actually moved forward with retrofits from New York State, because I'm pretty sure that they are tracking that because of the statewide initiative called Empower New York. Essentially, they have information about what type of retrofits, how many retrofits actually happened, and some of that information can probably be, I could probably work on getting some of that together and get it back to you so that at least New York State, you can kind of get an idea. I know from my own personal experience, we would put together bundles of homeowners, about 10 homeowners, that were interested, and this wasn't just a low-income homeowner, but these were homeowners kind of from the middle income to the upper end of the income scale. We would put bundles of like 10 homeowners together and have them go through the whole process of having the energy audit together in what we call the in bundling or an aggregation project. And on average, I would say only about 3 out of 10 of went through. So, you know, I know that some other folks have mentioned single digits. Through our aggregation program, where some homeowners were kind of vetted and even asked very early on if it made sense for them to move forward and have work done, would they be willing to have work done? And they all said yes. Only 3 out of 10 of those homeowners moved forward. But I can get some more information about the low-income program specifically just to see, because I know that more oftentimes some of those low-income projects that had the small $5,000 kind of budget for an insulation project, a lot more often those would move forward because the property owner saw it as a free investment in their home. It benefited the tenants, so the tenants were signing up for it. You know, just knowing if it was there. I'm also curious myself to know how successful that program was. Well, I'll dig into that and try to get you some numbers.
Yeah, that would be
back.
Very interesting. I'll send that off to the group if you can send that to me, or anything else anybody wants to send me on stats, that'd be great. Here in Boulder, it was mandatory that they the landlords do energy efficiency improvements on their buildings. So that kind of solved that problem.
Sierra, we're actually using that ordinance as one of the case studies for ours.
Good. Yeah, it seems to be working because we certainly have plenty of rentals around here. I don't think anybody's left as a result. So
I would think that ACEEE would have data on that energy efficiency work on a statewide basis because they do those scorecards every year. Imagine we could look up reports from them that show they rank cities and states and show how their energy efficiency has increased or decreased.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, we're at the hour.
I wanted to just one quick
ahead.
Thing, Sierra.
Absolutely.
One of the things that we found. And I mentioned is the pay-as-you-save, the on-meter tariff program. That program I know has seen pretty high uptake rates. I'm just looking at a case study that they sent us, and they had about 8,500 meters in Wachita Electric Co-op, and then of that they had 300 people use their pay-as-you-save program, which is, I think, what we were saying. It was about, that's about 3.5%. But 94% acceptance rate of those 300 offers. So of the people that sort of looked at it, 94% took action. So that's pretty great.
That's extremely high, yes. That's encouraging. And you were also mentioning that healthcare savings, is that the same thing you're talking about?
Oh, no, that's a completely different program.
Interesting program. I'd like to investigate that more. So,
where was that?
Yeah, you probably missed that. Go ahead, Michael.
So that was Wachita, O-U-A-C-H-I-T-A. The utility runs the pay-as-you-save program there. And so it's an on-meter tariff. So it's not tied to an individual. It's tied to a meter. So if a renter moves out, the repayment gets picked up by the next tenant, whoever turns on the electric. It's been done, I think, over 60 utilities in the country so far, and the default rate has been almost zero.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'll send this to you, Sierra.
No, that'd be great. I can forward these to other, the group. All right. Well, we have a webinar on microgrids coming up in October. It's going to be October 3rd. And our next call, I'm not sure what exactly it's going to be, but I'm going to see if I can get a hold of Matthew Marshall up in Redwoods, California. California, and they have a floating wind turbine farm, the first one in the country. I thought everybody might be pretty interested in that. Is anything going on in the wind in any of your areas? That's another good question. No?
We had 14.
Not so much.
In the last 2 weeks.
What was that now? I'm sorry, Sherry.
Oh, we had 14 plus tornadoes in the last few weeks.
Yeah, it's not quite what I was thinking. But. Yeah, that's pretty high for Wisconsin, actually. So, all right, thanks so you guys for coming, and Jason and Rob, Michael, for being on the panel, and for everybody else to attend. And we'll talk to you next time. Now,
thank you.
Yeah, bye.
All right,
thank you.
Thanks.